You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Sasha Woodruff, in for Gemma Gaudette. The Delta mutation is surging COVID-19 cases here in Idaho and across the country. But this is not the first mutation to spike infections, and it won't be the last. To understand how viruses thrive and evolve, we turn to Andrew Pekosh, a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to Idaho Matters.
It's great to be on here. Thank you for having me, Sasha.
Hey, so let's just start with a really broad question. You work with viruses. What is a virus and what is its purpose?
Well, you know, a virus is probably the most simplest form of life that exists. It really is just a relatively small piece of DNA or RNA in the case of SARS-CoV-2 that has the ability to replicate itself. And, you know, there's no thought behind a virus. There's no strategizing behind a virus. It really is Darwin's principles of natural selection, where the virus just wants to replicate and spread to its next host. And in that process, mutations accumulate that allow that virus to do that more effectively.
Right. And so, you know, as they have a purpose of just surviving, but they can't duplicate in a vacuum. What do they need to reproduce?
Yep. All viruses need some sort of a host. At the smallest level, it's the cells in someone's body. At a larger level, viruses tend to have very specific hosts. There are viruses that infect bacteria. There are viruses that infect sea animals, viruses that infect birds, viruses that infect humans. And in many cases, those viruses eventually evolve to be very closely linked to one particular species and have become sort of optimized for being able to replicate in that particular species. It's, you know, it's very rare that we see a virus that can jump to multiple different kinds of animals or families because they specialize so quickly.
Now, the COVID-19 virus has sort of hit a jackpot with humans. Can you just tell me about some of the, how it has evolved and where are we now with the mutations?
Absolutely. I think when SARS-CoV-2 first entered the population, it was surprising on two levels. One is it was able to spread fairly efficiently between humans, and we know this was the first time it really entered the human population. So to be so adapted to spread in humans was a little bit of a surprise. I think it also then surprised us in the fact that it was able to cause a real wide spectrum of disease, ranging from very mild to almost no symptoms, to the very severe cases that put people in the hospital and die from it. So it showed that whole spectrum of disease almost immediately. And as any virologist would have expected, as it continued to spread in the population, mutations occurred randomly, but the ones that gave the virus an advantage, making it easier to infect people, maybe replicating to higher levels, being able to start to evade some of the immunity that people were getting, those viruses came to the top. And those are the things that we call variants. They're viruses that are completely related to the original SARS-CoV-2, but have picked up a lot of mutations that allow it to now replicate and spread among humans much more efficiently than the initial strains were.
So mutations are integral to a virus's survival. Can you just tell us about some of the conditions where the COVID-19 virus is mutating and trying to, you know, get ahead of things like vaccinations and other barriers to its life?
Yeah, mutations in a virus are completely random. So the virus doesn't know which genes it's mutating. It just accumulates mutations at random. And then it's really the selection afterwards. Does this mutation do something that allows the virus to spread in the population more effectively that gets selected for? We know the most about the spike protein. It's called the S protein. It's the protein that the virus uses to attach and get into cells. And we know that since the beginning of the pandemic, the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2 has evolved to bind to cells much more strongly. It can now enter cells much more quickly, and it's starting to accumulate mutations that help it avoid the immune responses that are generated through vaccination or infection. So if this was a textbook, this virus is doing everything that I would write about in a textbook that a virus should do when it enters a new host. And it's done so in a very, very short period of time when we think about it.
And so can you explain just the probability of viable mutations and how that relates to host availability?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, mutations are random, and mutations that hinder the virus in some way, we almost never detect because those viruses don't replicate well, they don't spread, and they never come on our radar screen. The vast majority of mutations that we see in viruses are what we call neutral mutations. They neither hurt nor help. They just accumulate. But they've been incredibly useful, particularly in SARS-CoV-2, because they give the virus a sort of a timestamp so that we can now follow those viruses and we can follow chains of transmission. We know certain mutations occurred in southern England, and those viruses, when they spread globally, we can then trace back how those viruses moved and understand something about the spread of the virus. And then the final thing is the mutations that help the virus spread and move in the population. Those rarely occur. But again, in the short time of the pandemic, we've seen a number of them occur in the SARS-CoV-2 genome. These mutations that help the virus replicate, again, they're no likely to occur as opposed to mutations that don't hurt the virus. We see more of them accumulating as we see more and more virus replication in the community. Viruses aren't mutating faster. We're just seeing a lot more infected people and therefore a lot more virus mutations coming through.
Because they have more hosts to replicate in, correct?
Absolutely. It really becomes a numbers game after a while. The more people that get infected, the more viruses are replicated, the more viruses are thrown out, and then you just naturally accumulate all of these mutations that are present in the virus.
Okay, so right now we have the Delta variant, and it is thriving here in Idaho, in lots of different places in the country and across the world. Can you tell us a little bit about that life cycle and where it could be going? Could it die out soon?
Yeah, so Delta represents, the most fit form of SARS-CoV-2 that we've seen to date. We've seen here in the U.S. and in virtually every country where Delta has been detected, it rapidly becomes the dominant version of SARS-CoV-2 in that population. Delta appears to be really good at binding and getting into cells very quickly. Vaccines are still working against Delta. I think that's a really important point to continue to get across. But we've seen more vaccine breakthrough cases with Delta, probably because it is a stronger virus, a more fit virus than previous variants. So we're seeing Delta sort of knocking on the door of our vaccine efficacy and our public health interventions. But things are still holding strong when vaccination and public health interventions are really put into place effectively.
Okay, we are speaking with Andrew Pekosh, a professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Now, Delta is not going to be our last variant. Can you maybe just talk about what variants you're looking at on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. As virologists, we're always trying to look ahead and we're trying to see where the virus will be 2 months from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, so we can start to prepare for that. Right now, we're seeing with Delta something really interesting from a virology standpoint. The sequences in Delta are getting very, very different. So we're seeing right now we can characterize over 20 different sublineages in Delta, which essentially is telling us that the Delta is replicating and sending off new variants in and of themselves. None of them seem right now to be more dangerous than the original one, but we're paying attention to that. And then just recently, the World Health Organization announced a new variant of concern, Mu, M-U, which has been present in parts of South America for some time now. That's another one that seems to have sequences that put it on our radar screen. It seems to evade immune responses better than Delta. It also has some signature mutations that will probably make it infect cells faster, just like Delta does. But Delta has still outcompeted that one in many places. So we're looking in the future to see where this virus might emerge at, but we haven't seen telltale signatures yet of what the next variant or the next Delta version is going to come through.
And what does that mean for the future of vaccines?
Well, for now, vaccines are holding against Delta. One of the things we really want to pay attention to is to make sure that the virus doesn't change in a way that gets around that immunity even more effectively. So we're paying attention to the spike protein mutations, looking to see if if new variants emerge that have additional mutations that might evade immunity. From a population perspective, the US is in a really difficult place right now. We've got about half the population vaccinated and about half the population not vaccinated. So the unvaccinated population can generate lots of viruses and mutants, and those viruses then come into contact with vaccinated people, and it's as if the virus will be probing the vaccinated people to try to break through, and the variants that might infect the vaccinated better are being generated in the unvaccinated population. So it's a difficult place to be right now from a population perspective with respect to the immunity, but the vaccines still seem to be holding up well.
Okay, now Idaho has been fairly relaxed with preventative measures like masking and gathering limits. So, what did those conditions mean for new mutations?
It just increases the amount of opportunities the virus has to find another host. I think in some ways we saw vaccines as being sort of the way that we were going to defeat the virus completely. And I still think that that's true. It's just that we have to realize that vaccines take a while to have their effect, and we have to have a really high level of vaccine acceptance in order to see the effect of a vaccine on reducing virus spread. That has happened in a number of other countries which have reached higher vaccination levels than we have. Just hasn't happened here in the US because we just have too many pockets of unvaccinated individuals that allow this virus to replicate and spread almost unabated at times.
So we're just giving them pathways to evolve and mutate.
Absolutely. And again, it's more mutations equals, or I should say, more virus replication equals more mutations. And eventually, this virus is going to hit the lottery and find better mutations to spread. One of the analogies I use is, if your chances of winning the lottery is 1 in a million, and I give you 10 tickets, well, your chance of getting the lottery is rather low. But if I gave you 900,000 tickets, you have a pretty good chance of finding that one winning lottery ticket. And by letting the virus replicate unabated, we're essentially giving the virus lottery tickets and just waiting for it to find those key mutations that will allow it to be even better than it is now.
And last year, there were strains of the flu virus that actually went extinct. So, can you explain why that happened?
Oh, yeah. With influenza, these public health interventions that did a good job of limiting SARS-CoV-2 turned out to do a much better job of limiting a lot of the seasonal respiratory viruses that we're normally used to. And influenza was one example. So much so that there were several, we'll call them variants, of influenza that seemed to stop circulating in the human population. Now, we think that was because influenza is very different from SARS-CoV-2 in that there's actually a large number of people that have immunity to influenza through vaccination or through previous infections. And so when you put public health interventions in place, those combined with immunity in the population to really drastically limit the number of hosts that the virus could see. And so much so that several of the strains just seem to have gone extinct. As we enter the fall now, those public health interventions aren't in place anymore. So we would expect to see new variants, to use the SARS-CoV-2 phrase, of influenza entering in the population and perhaps seeing even increased cases because, again, we don't have that second arm, the public health interventions in place to limit the spread of influenza. It's something that eventually will work for SARS-CoV-2 if we can get the population immunity high enough.
So we're looking at trying to balance public health measures, masking, distancing, quarantining, along with the technology that goes along with vaccines. And that could be, that is the place of hope for the COVID-19 pandemic.
Absolutely. We oftentimes look to measles as an example of how this works. When we get 90% of the population immunized against measles, it's very unlikely that anybody will catch a case of measles, even if you're not vaccinated. We don't know what that magic number is yet for SARS-CoV-2, but I'm sure that there is one. And as soon as we get to that level of immunity, we're going to see a major change with respect to the massive reduction in the numbers of severe cases of SARS-CoV-2 and in deaths. The issue is we can get to that immunity level the easy way through vaccination, or we can get there the hard way, which is through infection. And I really am trying to get more people to understand that easy way to vaccination is the best way and the safest way for us to get back to what life was like pre-COVID.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dr. Pekosh. That was Andrew Pekosh, professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And up next, how your garden can grow a new harvest as temperatures cool. I'm Sasha Woodruff, and you are listening to Idaho Matters.